imagination is reproduction. Why is it imagination? Very simple. Imagination is awareness of an object that is not present. Ergo, the work of reproduction is a work of imagination. To hold on to what Husserl calls the retentive synthesis. Right? I mean, the three-hole synthesis is, you know, like Husserl's retentive and protentive syntheses. But the idea here is it's imagination, because whenever you are aware of something that's not present, that is literally imagination. That's simply what the word imagination means. And it's now this structure now of holding on to a past as past for the sake of a particular future. Okay. Apperception, apperceptive self-awareness, the I think I must accompany all my representations, what's all that about? Let's start at a very low level and then work up to it and get it complicated and talk about the paralogisms as a way of clarifying the meaning of it. What is Kant interested in talking about apperception? Well, one thing he's not interested in is the ontological unity of the mind. Nor is he interested in the problem of criteria of personal identity. Nor, maybe a little more surprisingly, is he interested in the ownership of mental states. Well, that doesn't seem to leave much. I'm going to suggest that apperception is simply the reflexive act in which the mind grasps its own representations as representations. Which is to say, apperception turns out to be no different than judgment. Okay, let's see how we can get there a little bit. The word apperception, of course, is a Leibnizian word. And in Leibniz, it involved reflexive awareness of the self or I, the monad being aware of itself. And the question then will become, why did Leibniz coin such a term? What was he thinking about? And why did Kant decide to appropriate Leibniz's word for his own devious purposes? And the answer to that is the following, that Leibniz, as every history of psychoanalysis tells us, discovered the unconscious. By which Leibniz called the unconscious petite perception, little perceptions. How little? So little you don't even notice them. So for Leibniz, it was an obvious thing that there could be perceptions of which we were unaware. Very low-grade ones. And therefore, for Leibniz, it further followed that because he believed that there were ideas of which we were unaware or unconscious, that thought required something other than ideas or perceptions. Well, what's the other thing that was required for thought, if not merely having ideas or perceptions? Namely, that they were apperceived, that is, perceived by me. So apperception in Leibniz is necessary for thought. I don't want to get lost in Leibniz, but the background is important for Kant. That is, it doesn't follow from the having or their existing or their being ideas or perceptions that they play a functional role in cognitive activity, even if they can play other kinds of role. So Kant's going to want to say that to be conscious of my representations as representing me which I'm saying is what apperception is why say be aware of representations as representing is the work of apperception. Sounds like there's a missing step. And the missing step is that the representations are coming to function as a point of view for me. That is, a judgment just is my view onto something. So that it is the implied judger in the judgment. Because every judgment is going to be made by a judgment. So another way of putting it is to say that all conscious thought or perception involves an ineliminable first-person perspective. That insofar as we are thinking, we are individually taking a stand upon judging what occurs, and that in a certain sense is ineliminable. We cannot be written out of the story. So there is, of course, just to remind you, a Tractarian analog here. You know, when Wittgenstein says, you know, if I was to write a story of the world as I found it, what I would have, of course, is a complete description of the world, but there would be something missing. Namely, the eye, with this thick eyebrow, you get a Jewish eye, the eye seeing the world. Well, my suggestion is, for in a technical way, of course, that I is the I, and it is the thought that every judgment on a world, just as in the Tractatus, is a point of view onto the world from which the I, from which it is seen, that perspective is ineliminable. And what Kant has to show is the role of that I
This one. Not that one.
In making that possible. And of course, like Leibniz, Kant believes, says in various places, there can be unconscious ideas. So he's going to say that in virtue of apperceiving a representation, I represent or perceive the object of that representation. Let me say that again, since this is my version or the beginning of my deflationary argument. In virtue of apperceiving a representation, I represent or perceive the object of that representation. So, the upshot of apperception is object awareness. So, apperception just is, in a certain way, object awareness. So what Kant has to convince us of is object awareness contains within it this I think moment as a non-isolable moment. Non-isolable moment, non-separable, not capable of being isolated from the judgment itself, or rather the awareness of the object. To say it another way is to say that to apperceive a representation is just to engage in synthesis. Okay, well, let's look at how Kant builds up this idea. In the first edition reduction, and then we will look at how he deflates it in the paralogisms. That is, does the job of teasing us away from thinking that we've discovered something deep here about the nature of the self. What he wants to do is therefore inflate the role of the self in a certain way, make it fundamental, and then deflate the fact that we may have discovered anything interesting about the self, since the whole story is going to be cashed out in terms of judgment. That's the strategy. If anyone so intends, I feel like I've said something rude. No? Where shall we start? Let's start with B133. That's a typical place to launch into this topic. So he says, for the empirical consciousness, which accompanies different representations, is in itself diverse and without relation to the identity of the subject. What does he mean by that?
Perception?
It's not prior, the trickier is empirical.
What are you right in saying, like, our dogs and cats also have empirical consciousness in this way, but not identity of themselves as subjects?
It might be. But the thought is actually just more low-grade Humean. It's if I'm having a actual perception of the lectern, and I look inside my mind and ask myself, you know, what am I experiencing? Then if I hunt around, I'll have, you know, lectern-like experiences, and then I'll have, you know, cup experiences, and, you know, then I'll have Barry Salmon experiences, but I won't have me experiences. So my empirical consciousness, that is the actual psychological stuff of my mind, so empirical consciousness now is the actual psychological flow of life. And that is pretty much just as Hume described it, and is as diverse, and when we look inside, just as Hume said, we don't stumble upon a idea or impression of the self. We just stumble upon the stuff of experience. Fair enough. That relation comes about not simply through my accompanying each representation with consciousness. Relation to the self does not come about by giving each event So at some time, I walk out in my hallway, this happens all the time in my hallway, anyway. I walk out in my hallway, and it's one of the happiest moments of the day, right? My neighbor is cooking breakfast, and boy, that bacon smell. Oh man, I love that bacon smell. I'm not allowed to eat bacon. Oh, Friday. There I got it. So in my mind, I've got a bacon smell and an egg smell. And I can, of course, say, I smell bacon and I smell eggs. That is, I can accompany each with a I, but that's not relation to the self. According to Kant. So the relation is not the lifting up of something and simply saying, I'm conscious of it. Rather, the consciousness occurs only insofar as I can join one representation with another. That is, I am smelling bacon and eggs. That is what is involved here is the work of conjoining them in a single thought. And am aware of that conjoining, he says. What does it mean to be aware of that conjoining? What does it mean to be aware of that conjoining?
To make a judgment.
Well, it certainly means to make a judgment.
sympathetic intuition.
More ordinary language. It doesn't mean to be aware of conjoining. Yeah.
It means you recognize that there are two things that you're making one thing, or combining into one thing.
Okay. It means you're aware that you are smelling bacon and eggs. I say it faster. But it's so that your awareness of the I is your awareness of the fact that you're having a complex awareness. It's the awareness of the complex awareness that is your awareness that you have combined that, right? So it's not that you're aware of an activity. He's not saying something dumb like that. He's saying that you're aware of the synthesis if you're aware of the complexity itself, that is, the unity in complexity. So only insofar, now he's going to up the ante, whoosh, now it's only insofar as I can unite a manifold of given representations in one consciousness, is it possible for me to represent the identity of the consciousness in or throughout these representations? What's that about? Only insofar as I can unite these in one representation. We're doing a given manifold now. We're going to get non-given manifolds later. We're keeping it simple for you. A given manifold of bacon and egg smells, that will be enough. In one consciousness, is it possible for me to represent the identity of consciousness in or throughout those representations? Let me ask a lesser question. What does it mean to be possible for me to represent to myself the identity of my consciousness throughout these representations? Yeah?
Your hand lady?
Yo, your knuckle clinching gambit. The thought, again, it's sometimes so simple, right? It's that only if I can form a unity of this, is it possible for me to think of the experience as my perspective onto the world. Because if there was no unity here, then there would be no point of view upon the world. But there is a point of view onto the world, independent of me, precisely because I can identify the complexity of the world as there. So in unifying them in a judgment, I make my representations of an object, I smell bacon and eggs, and therefore implicitly acknowledge that it is one and the same being that is having egg smells and bacon smells and judging them and holding that judgment together at one time in one place. I know you didn't know you were doing all of that. That's what you're doing. So, this unity of consciousness is something that cannot be empirical. That is, it's not the unity of a it's not the judgment.
What do I mean by it's not empirical?
I mean when I'm aware of I smell bacon and eggs, I don't have anything as rich as the claim the very person Jay Bernstein is smelling bacon and eggs. There's no thought of who the identity, who the self is of the judgment, right? So the self here is not a thick self, but furthermore, the unity given bacon and eggs is not formed by the mere empirical conjunction of the two. So Kant says, so B134, it should be the page. Kant says the thought, the representations given in intuition, one and all belong to me, is therefore equivalent to the thought that I unite them in one self-consciousness, or can at least so unite them, And although this thought is not itself the consciousness of the synthesis of representations, it presupposes the possibility of synthesis. In other words, it's the in other words I'm interested in here, only insofar as I can grasp the manifold of the representations in one consciousness, do I call them one and all mine, for otherwise I would have as many colored and diverse a self as I have representations of which I am conscious to myself. So this goes back to the empirical consciousness thought, right? The unity cannot be empirical because the unity is above and beyond the mere content of the judgment. It's the unity of the form of the judgment, that is, or the unity of judgment itself. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a, and this is all I want out of the word mind, there wouldn't again be my point of view onto the world. So, what Kant is thinking of here is something like the following. This is the example everyone always gives from James. If I assign to each individual one word of, say, a word of verse, so you would say, "Twas brillig, is the slithy toes, did dive and gimble in the wave." Now, if each of them said it and held their ears at the same time, right, you would not get a fault. That what makes a thought is not that they are accompanied by consciousness. Each of those are perfectly well accompanied by consciousness. It's that the unity of them is what makes the thought. Otherwise, it's gibberish. You may say, "'Twas brillig is gibberish." I like it because it's almost sense. So the idea is that there has to be more than, to put it another way, a mere association of ideas. That's the subtext of all of this, is that association of ideas won't yield a thought. That is, the mere association of whenever I smell eggs, I smell bacon, or there are bacon smells and there are egg smells, won't be a thought about my relationship, my having the experience of smelling bacon and eggs. That what makes it my smelling bacon and eggs is not the mere association of ideas, but their unity. So that is their synthesis that does the work. Well, what is this synthesis, and what is it aware of in uniting them? At A108, and of course it is a provocation here of an obvious kind that I'm leaping between the A and the B deductions as if there's no difference. So here's a kind of classic statement of what Kant's thinking about. Where do I want to start? I'm going to start very late, because I want to read all of this now. Let's just read the end of the paragraph. For the mind, top page 137, if you've got Testament. For the mind could never think its identity in the manifoldness of its representations, and indeed think this identity a priori, if it did not have before its eyes the identity of its act, whereby it subordinates all synthesis of apprehension, which is empirical, to a transcendental unity, thereby rendering possible their interconnection according to a priori rules. The identity of the acts. Now, what Kant is certainly suggesting here is the following. That what must stay the same throughout all our encounters with the world is the functions of judgment. That there would be no point, literally no point, in judging that the chair is green if one could not recognize that one was involved in the same activity when you judge the chair next to it as blue. That what makes it meaningful is not the having of the raw experience of chairness and blueness together and chairness and redness together. It's rather the awareness that I'm judging subject predicate form. This chair is blue, this chair is red. And I am aware of that I am doing the same act each time. And it's the same act each time that gives significance to the individual experiences themselves and allows me to relate them. You're shaking your head terribly. Why?
No, I was just thinking about who would hold me accountable later with each time, and how it's just about how to go on doing the same thing.
Right. You know? Yeah, you have to be aware of that this is doing the same. Because if it ain't doing the same, then you're doing nothing. So what is now? Well, here's the pitch. To be aware of it as the same is lo and hold to be aware of yourself. That's what it is to be aware of yourself. That is that I am judging, so the suppressed now, I am judging this chair is blue. So being aware of that I'm participating in the same act in each case, subordinating each apprehension to the same form, is the way Kant puts it here, right? Means that I am aware that I am taking a point of view on the chair that is red and the chair that is blue, and connecting them as what? As being different colored chairs. That's what gives, I mean, otherwise, it's nothing. So it's the bringing of the form, the logical form of the judgment to it. That is my relationship onto it, right? And makes it my point of view onto the world. So that what I spontaneously contribute to the situation, what's not there in the greenness of the chair or the blueness of the chair, is the judgmental form. And the judgmental form that treats objects as having, as being, let's say, things with properties. That's what I contribute, right? Of course, Kant's not saying that there aren't things in the world, but things in the world, again, don't come in, as it were, forms in which the logical functions of judgment can get a grip on them, right? That we bring that to our encountering, and it's how our encountering becomes our relationship to the object. From this it follows, since this is what we contribute to the world, its form, what powers we have, that we can distinguish ourselves from the objects of judgment. Since the form is not in the things, as every goddamn page of Hume testifies to, right? Since he misses the form. Poor Hume. I feel like I always teach another Hume course and say why he's his sweetheart. But anyway. That, and this is why Hume couldn't distinguish himself, right? And why he ran into his terrible, terrible skeptical dilemmas. That it is in virtue of the deployment of the logical functions of judgment that I can distinguish myself from the objects of judgment. So the I here is a spontaneous self which judges. and that this spontaneity, this is B132. Again, I know you think I make all this up, and I hope all, but I really am struggling, just like you are, to read this text.
When did you say B?
132?
132. Just to get spontaneity on the books. That representation, which can be given prior to all thought, is entitled intuition. All the manifold of intuition has therefore a necessary relation to the I think in the same subject in which this manifold is found, but this representation is an act of spontaneity that is cannot be regarded as belonging to sensibility. So, it's the spontaneity by means of which I contribute these logical functions that allows me then, implicitly now, to separate the self that judges from the thing judged. And it follows from this that we must be able, now to give the Kantian little cha-cha-cha, that we must be able to add the I think, that is the judging self, to each judgment, or one of the necessary conditions for judgment would not be fulfilled. And if spontaneity is a condition, because they're logical forms. The logical forms are not in the world. They're products of spontaneity. Spontaneity, well, what's spontaneous? Well, I am, right? Then I must be able to add the self to the judgment, or the conditions of judgment would not be fulfilled. And therefore, to make a judgment is an act of self-consciousness, because it, right, precipitates the difference between self and object. That is, you cannot make a judgment without being aware of your difference from the thing judged. That's what's involved in the judgment. And I'm not suggesting, again, that this is separable. Again, I'm not saying that this is anything different than saying, damn, those bacon and eggs smell good, right? That is self-awareness here, right? As soon as I say, damn, it's my point of view on the object, right? I've got an object of which I am aware. That's the I think. Well, the question now becomes, and we're not going to talk about it today, just lo and behold, as the saying goes, time has run out again. So time is finite after all. The question now is, how thick or thin is this self? How much do we learn about the self by requiring this spontaneity? And what are its implications for the understanding of what we call subjectivity? And we will start with those questions next week, which is I'll start with the paralogisms. And then I think we'll handle it this way, because I think I do not want to start the B deduction and then have the spring break. So next week what I will do is do the paralogisms, and I'll finish off the A deduction, or pretend to. And that will let you gather up what I'm calling the materials necessary for understanding Kant's core argument. Again, I'm not trying to make an argument here. I'm trying to get the pieces of the argument motivated so that when we can see, if I can get the elements there, then perhaps, you know, say when the time comes, we can see how they hang together. Okay, any questions before we have, again, we'll have the discussion section later, but any questions before we begin? Maybe there are some Christian-esque students here. Yeah.
So just as there are no problems with unconscious representations, what would we say about unconscious judgments? Or is that a note?
For Kant, that is a contradiction. Because setting up a judgment is making a self-world distinction. I guess we could talk about, you know, subconscious judgment as well. Implicit judgment as well. Yeah. But they all have a certain structure. Okay, well, let's then have another 5 or 10 minute break. And then again, this is going to be